Good evening, good morning, welcome to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, sitting in for George Norrie. I'm Dave Schrader. Thank you very much for joining me. Got an interesting show coming your way this evening. With the popularity and glut of all the paranormal programming that's been inundating our TV airwaves for the last 10 years, so many more questions arise. What are we really experiencing? What is a ghost and what constitutes a haunting? Bill Murphy is a researcher and producer of paranormal-themed documentaries that include his new pending release that investigates the origin of a haunting. His work has been licensed for broadcast on the Biography Channel, and he has appeared on the Discovery Channel. And he was the co-lead host of the hit international series Fact or Faked Paranormal Files. His latest documentary, nearing completion, is titled The Pearl Experiment, which chronicles the successful effort to record evidence of what some people may claim to be a ghost, which was conjured through the use of a custom experimental device. This is an experiment that I was actually on hand for, and I'm interested to talk with Bill about this and how this continues to grow. His research in understanding what is our place in the field of the paranormal. Are we creating hauntings? Are we feeding some sort of energy to take on manifestations? Or are we merely bolstering what is already there? We've got a lot to talk about tonight. A lot of interesting things coming your way. Bill Murphy, our guest. Can we create ghosts? Stay tuned and find out. That'll come next on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening, Dave Schrader, sitting in for George Norrie. Times and beliefs on what constitutes a haunting are changing. Are the living the real reason behind hauntings and manifestations? Are we actually the ones creating them? Tonight, we're going to discuss this and the influence of us, the living, on the involvement in experiencing the paranormal with our guest, Bill Murphy. Bill, welcome back to Coast AM.
Dave, it's good to be here.
Bill, this is something that fascinates me because, you know, we've known each other 8 or 9 years now. We've investigated multiple locations together. We've witnessed some of the most stunning paranormal encounters, from the voice of Jackie, the little girl that haunts the Queen Mary first class pool section, to strange encounters and anomalies at the Stanley Hotel, in the Manor House, and beyond, to a very interesting experiment that you did in California, the Pearl Experiment, which we're going to get into in a little bit. I want to kind of start off with a little history lesson for our listeners, and I know many of them know some of this, but let's begin by piecing it together, because this isn't a new theory and thought so much as there have been others that have looked at the idea of how much influence do we as people have on creating a haunting. Maybe you could start us off talking a little bit about the Philip experiment and catching people up to date with what that was, how that came about, and was it successful?
According to the participants of the Toronto Society for Psychical Research that conducted the Philip experiment, and this was led by Iris Owen, a very interesting paranormal researcher, according to them, yes, it was successful. When you look at what they recorded, which is mainly it was table tipping sessions, and there were odd raps and knocking sounds that were, there was no visual connection to these sounds. So, but according to them, these were responses to questions that they were asking of a fictitious ghost that they wrote a history of. And since they were getting responses, they then published that they thought they were successful in creating what appears to be a poltergeist.
And they had come to this experiment with the idea that if we focus and create a backstory, give this quote-unquote ghost a history and energy, will we get, in effect, response from it? And from my understanding, they would ask questions. They'd set all these parameters up. They would ask questions then about things that this ghost would know, and it responded in kind. But when they would ask questions that they hadn't really kind of preloaded for this energy or spirit, it would not answer. Was that the type of communication they were getting, as you understand it?
No, that's not exactly what they reported. It's after they started to get responses to questions where they had written a history for, they then began to expand the experiment and ask questions where they did not write an answer for. And they were getting responses to those questions as well. And this is when it appeared, according to the researchers, that Philip broke away from being purely an experimental thought form to gaining some independence somehow, because they did not provide the information where the answers could have been used by Philip, the fictitious ghost. And so that's when it became a thought form.
All right, and for people that don't really understand a thought form, kind of explain to us, what is the theory behind a tulpa or a thought form creation?
These are all manifestations of mental energy, and they have characteristics that would suggest that they're discarnate personalities. And for those not familiar with the term discarnate, it means without a material body, yet an intelligence and a personality seems to reside in a location, and you can interact with that intelligence. And a tulpa is, you know, that's something that has been going on by thousands of years in Tibet. They would create a tulpa. But the difference between the way it was done by in Tibet with the monks, they would create a tulpa, and they would always have a process of dissolving the tulpa, for the same reason that the Toronto Society learned, and that's these thought forms tend to break away and they start to give signs that they're thinking and behaving independently of those that created them in the first place. And then they can become a little more mischievous or cause harm that they, of course, never intended to have happen. And that was something that the team associated with the Philip experiment started to learn. It's like, wow, you know, we gave Philip sort of a story that's closed in. One of the very important components that they wrote was a tragic life for Philip, because his love, who was burned at the stake, falsely accused of witchcraft, caused Philip to throw himself off the walls of the manor that he lived in, and then he haunted the manor as a soul that could no longer be restful. So they wanted to incorporate that tragedy simply because stories of that nature are what normally are associated with these, you know, lingering ghost stories that sort of last for centuries. And so they wrote Philip that way, you know, gave him a timeline of haunting for hundreds of years, having that tragic life, throwing himself off the wall. And they said, okay, that's how these ghost stories seem to take hold. Let's see if Philip will take hold. And to everyone's surprise, Philip did seem to take hold.
Well, now there's a more contemporary version that a lot of people are familiar with and may not realize that it started as nothing more than a story, but the Slender Man storyline kind of follows in the same vein, doesn't it?
It sure does. And I love that story. And I'm glad you brought up Slender Man, because it is very contemporary. And anybody that is, you know, now internet savvy likely knows of Slender Man, and that's where he was born. And the interesting thing about Slender Man is that the media associated with Slender Man from the creators put him back into the 1950s. And so he seemed to, you know, he shows up in these archive photos, which were, it was photoshopped, and they really weren't intending to hoax anybody per se. It was more of a social experiment. And it sort of took root, and it's become part of popular folklore of Slender Man, you know, this, you know, many armed, tall, elongated, looks like a male figure wearing a hat, would abduct children and appear around children in playgrounds. And so there was this, you know, fear factor associated with Slender Man, but he's really, at this point, only, you know, less than 10 years old.
And he's truly one of the first effects that we can actually, these urban legends that we can track back to its initial inception. and where it came from. But now people do claim that they do witness Slender Man. They've seen Slender Man. They've photographed him. And some, I understand some were done for an experimental deal and they were photoshopped in, but there are people now that claim to have captured video, photographic evidence, eyewitness testimony of seeing this character, which then lends ourselves to believe, did Slender Man always exist? And we peeled back those layers and now people can see him because we're aware of him. Or did we create something that has taken on a life of its own?
It's a wonderful question, and I think any attempt at answering would raise even more questions. The great thing about Slender Man being born of the internet age, the internet itself and search engines, when you collate all that information and they look at what terms are being searched for more and more, it's considered by some people to be a reflection of a collective consciousness of what people want to know around the world. They're all looking for something, the certain answers they're trying to find, and finding images associated with these questions. And this group thought, this global thought, seems to impact many people very quickly. And perhaps that could be attributed to why Slender Man really has taken root. And maybe, Dave, what you're saying is true. Because people have seen the image and are now familiar with Slender Man, it could be, I'm not sure if it's an actual thought form that has been created or, pareidolia in some cases of people seeing a shape that they're now familiar with and in the fleeting shadows, they see what appears to be a Slender Man figure. Because, yes, you're right. There are now eyewitness reports of people seeing Slender Man.
Well, and there's been this strange uprise in other characters, too, and we've noticed it on our show, Darkness Radio, with the black-eyed kids phenomena, which, you know, as of 2 or 3 years ago, there really wasn't any hype. There wasn't much talking about it, and there was really only one or two cases that you could find on the internet. Now there are entire sites dedicated to these stories, people that encounter these children in groups of anywhere from 1 to 3 of these kids that seem kind of dressed very plainly. Their eyes, the entire sclera is jet black. They're trying to get into your homes or get you to follow them somewhere, with the intent of nefarious activity, I guess. And you hear these stories, and now they seem to be taking on a life of their own. I'm getting stories from literally around the world. Now, could it be people trying to inject themselves into the legend? And like the urban legend, everybody adds a little bit of the ingredients to the stone soup to create this mythos, and it keeps getting larger. Or because there are so many people that are terrorized by the idea of these creepy children trying to get in, and we're pouring this kind of energy and intent into hearing the stories, passing the stories along. This is almost kind of like in the old Navajo tradition of storytelling and passing the legends through the family members. It seems that these stories are growing exponentially and creating something tangible that is frightening many people and making a real, almost measurable effect in the world. And to me, that's where my fascination with the paranormal really has kind of taken a quantum leap. Where did you begin? When we met 8-9 years ago, Bill, what was your belief at that time of what a ghost was?
Well, I think I was, my belief wasn't fully formed then. When I reached out to you, I was already a fan of your show, and I was interested in what you were doing, and you started to have these events, and I contacted you. I was actually searching for more answers simply because I didn't have a fully formed opinion. Growing up, my parents were interested in anthropology, world cultures, various religions. Even though they were practicing Christians, they were really interested in world religion, and they became art buyers of the art created in Haiti, which was mainly, voodoo-based art, and bringing that into New Orleans. And these large paintings were being sold in galleries all over. And my parents, they traveled around the world buying art, which was then sold into galleries. So there were art buyers. And so I was exposed to this, multicultural environment as a child growing up. I saw it. I didn't have the same interest my parents did. I think I appreciated it more from a cultural perspective, as opposed to looking deeper into the supernatural. Once I really started to take a look at claims of the paranormal and then, you know, read some books, some of them quite dated, on people reporting experiences of ghosts and hauntings, I wanted to do it in a way that would remove myself from the process a little bit, would not be subjective, and just objectively record evidence of it. So I took the science-based approach, and I was hoping to learn more. And so when you and I first met, the short answer to your question is that I would not have been able to answer if I thought a ghost exists or not.
9 years later, researching, investigating, filming, trying to look at it through a scientific lens, do you feel that what you might have had as a basis for an understanding of what ghosts were has changed in a massive way? Has there been a big ripple effect in your belief system?
Yes, there certainly has been. In the years that you and I have collaborated and corresponded and traveled to the same locations together, and me shooting a lot of video and being involved with a lot of EVP, you know, electronic voice phenomena, recording sessions, I started to accumulate so much evidence that I could not deny that there is anomalous communication. And by anomalous, for those that maybe not be so familiar with the term, it's something that isn't necessarily repeatable under similar conditions. And that's why mainstream science rejects it. And that's why it was a slow burn for me to be able to answer the question with a definitive yes today. I do believe that there is media and there's communication that is ending up on our devices, but that it still has not made it clear to me where this anomalous answers in images in audio, where it's originating. I'm getting closer, and that was one of the reasons why this experiment we did in 2007 was conducted, to see if I could get any closer to that answer.
Do you think that science is finally catching up to the supernatural? I've read books from, you know, the turn of the century, late 1800s, of some of the equipment and tools and ideas that they had then, and it really does not seem that much far removed from where we are now, you know, 100 years later. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are with technology. Do you think we're getting any closer to actually being able to use electronics, media to prove or disprove ghosts, electronic voice phenomena, spirit energy and anomalies, or do you think that we're still miles apart from when we're going to get that kind of definitive data?
I don't think that there is technology that exists just yet, simply because it's unknown what it is that we should be measuring if we're going to say, okay, this is evidence of any sort of residual energy, a discarnate personality. This is evidence of that energy, because, you know, we're basing the current tool set on an existing understanding of science and physics, and that always changes over time. I mean, when you go back just a few hundred years ago, not that far, just a few centuries, the idea of generating and harnessing electricity like we do today, it would have been unimaginable. You couldn't have done it. Now we take it for granted. In this room that I'm speaking to you in, you know, I got these lights burning, I'm talking to you on this phone. All this was impossible years ago, and I think people would have thought it had been far-fetched to propose it. However, once electricity was understood and the electromagnetic fields that are generated around any electric current and all electric currents, then some of the more modern theories started to crop up, almost from the very beginning, as a matter of fact. It was thought that a location that was giving signs of what they would call a haunting, they said that it was utilizing the wiring in the building for a manifestation. And I have articles from like 1910 that talk about this. And that was just when electricity was in its infancy. Buildings in the 1800s, many of them just had gas lamps. And electricity was unreliable and was burning down buildings, so a lot of people were scared of it. But once it became reliable, it quickly started to jump on EMF. And then photography hasn't advanced that much either, because they were using infrared-sensitive plates to photograph in the dark, thinking it could be of a spectrum that is invisible to human sight. And so These were forward-thinking people back then.
And isn't it interesting? We're going to take a break here in a second. We'll come back. We'll continue talking with Bill Murphy. But it almost seems interesting, like, was the supernatural waiting for us to catch up to them? Because even at the beginning of the advent of recording and photographs and telephones, there have been some form of spiritual communication coming through, as though it's been waiting for us to make these connections. The genesis of a ghost. We're going to talk more with Bill Murphy. Check out his website, ghosttown.tv. That's ghosttown.tv to find more information about his documentary. Stay tuned. More Coast to Coast continues right after this. Good evening. Thank you very much for joining me, filling in for George Norrie this evening. If you like the paranormal and supernatural and you're intrigued and would like to know more, then you can join me Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight Central Time, as I host Darkness Radio. And then keep your dial right there, because at darknessradio.com, we roll right into Coast to Coast AM. You can continue your journey with George Norrie and George Knapp 5 nights a week on our show. Tomorrow night, I'll be back hosting Coast to Coast AM, and I got a great show lined up for you. John Cameron is my guest. The topic is, it's me, Edward Wayne Edwards, the serial killer you never heard of. This is one of the most chilling cases I've ever come in contact with. It is a serial killer who made a pact with the devil and had what could be one of the most prolific 66-year career as a serial killer. He actually taunted law enforcement officials. He appeared on game shows. He appeared in a documentary about another famous murder in the background, as though snubbing his nose at everyone involved in the story, that the real killer was right in front of them and no one even knew who they were looking at. They have actually found that this man may be tied to famous crimes like the Black Dahlia murders, the Atlanta child killings, also dealing in the Zodiac case, all the way through the JonBenet Ramsey murders and the killings that made the West Memphis Three so famous. That's tomorrow night. John Cameron joins me, so I hope that you'll join me as well when I'm back with Coast to Coast AM. When we come back tonight, we're going to continue our journey talking with Bill Murphy about the genesis of the paranormal, the ghosts. Where do they come from? How do they exist? Are we creating these spirits? Are we giving them the energy to become, or do they already exist and we're just giving them the energy to bolster and become stronger? We'll talk about another famous ghost, the ghost of Jackie from the Queen Mary, with some startling revelations, but some very interesting evidence and stories that have been told and witnessed and documented for years. And then we're going to talk about the Pearl Experiment, bringing this experiment into the new age with stunning results. That takes place next on Coast to Coast AM. What is a ghost? What constitutes a haunting? That's what we're trying to focus on tonight with our guest, Bill Murphy. Again, you can check out his website at ghosttown.tv. That's ghosttown.tv. You can find information about him and about his amazing research and documentaries, The Stanley Effect, The Queen Mary, A Floating Phenomena, and The World's Largest Ghost Town, A Post-Katrina Paranormal Investigation. Those are the three DVDs on there, and soon The Pearl Experiment will be joining that as well. I mentioned the Queen Mary because that's a fascinating location that George Norrie has been there. I've been there. You've been there, Bill. We've been there for many different occasions, many different investigations, and we have had some of the most profound experiences aboard the ship. Now, one of the more fascinating stories to me is of the little girl Jackie, who haunts the first class pool area. And Peter James, the psychic and medium who was featured on Sightings and In Search Of and many different shows, became famous. And one of the reasons is because of his interaction with this amazing little ghost. You would hear her call out, sing out loud. They've caught shadowy photographs of a little girl moving about the pool area, videotape of the same thing. But this has a strange evolution of a story as well, as I understand it. Can you give us a little background on what you know about the ghost of Jackie?
Yes, Peter was able to have this interaction, just as you described, with the voice of a young girl that has been known as Jackie. But to fast forward it a little bit is that, you know, Peter died in 2006. I believe it was 2006. And the odd thing is that other investigators have come there and had those same sort of interaction with the same voice. As a matter of fact, one person I know, Bob Davis, he got very similar recordings and then subjected the recordings captured when Peter James was having this interaction to when Bob was, and the voices appeared to be the same, and that's why they sent it out for voice analysis by a company that does nothing but that voice analysis for law enforcement. They didn't want to be involved with the process, they being Bob and his team. They wanted another team that didn't really know the history to listen to these voices and say, are these the same or different people? And they came back that it was so similar. Some of the technology has changed from the 90s to the mid-2000s when the new recordings were happening, that, you know, they had to acknowledge that there's clarity now that there wasn't then, but the intonation and, you know, the scale of the voice seemed to match. So whatever is going on there is still there.
But now there are no records, is my understanding, of a little girl ever dying aboard the Queen Mary, let alone in the first-class pool area. And there's been rumors that it actually was a story that perpetrated from when another company owned the Queen Mary, and one of the, from my understanding, one of the workers saw what appeared to be a little wet footprint near the pool. And that kind of was the starting point of this girl ghost story in theory. What do you know much about that? Is there any information you can shed light on for that?
I have heard the same thing. As a matter of fact, I've shared that information with a number of people that research and investigate on the Queen Mary. I don't think everybody necessarily likes to hear that because there's a certain emotional investment in Jackie by those that have this communication and those that don't have an emotional investment and a time investment on the Queen Mary. You know, they also don't want to necessarily hear that either. But nobody can say with any certainty, as you pointed out, the origin of Jackie. But the stories that surround it, and you actually pointed out some interesting things with the wet footprints, that ended up getting built into there's some tile that was placed around the Queen Mary, and they were perforated in footprint shapes, and they actually had water lines underneath it because it became part of an attraction on the Queen Mary. And so the wet footprints could be turned on. It was simulated. So they would turn it on. They had fog machines. They made it an environment. They made it sort of like a safe kind of haunting, if that's a concept people can grab onto. And it just became part of the lore of the ship. But just like the rest of our conversation before the break, that doesn't necessarily explain why these similar voices are being recorded for, you know, 15 years, 17 years now.
We've got all of these strange circumstances. We've talked about the Philip experiment, the Slender Man, Jackie, the little girl ghost, who we've had, like I said, personal experiences with, and we've seen. One of the more fascinating, and I'll make it a quick story just because I think this is intriguing to me about what is our influence in the witnessing of the paranormal and in the experiencing of it. And I was there for communication with Jackie on a number of occasions on some electromagnetic field detectors and K2 meters that she was signaling. She would answer in the affirmative to answer questions. All of the equipment would go off simultaneously, thinking that maybe somebody was using a remote control starter or something to try to signal these detectors. I began asking her to just light up specific ones, which she was able to do repeatedly. And one of the times we were there using a tone generator, and I know the guys, Philip and Christopher Booth, were there filming this, and we encouraged her to sing Happy Birthday. And through this tone generator, you heard it sort of like humming Happy Birthday. And when it was done, everybody kind of applauded for her. And I said, well, that's great. Can you do London Bridge is Falling Down? And before I could even finish, she began buzzing, you know, and we were kind of hearing this humming, buzzing noise. And afterwards, again, there was some applause. Everybody was very excited. And the machine always had a background hum to it. And I said, well, that's great, Jackie. You've really impressed me. But now let me hear a little Inagata Da Vida by Iron Butterfly. And the machine stopped. Not a sound, not a background hum, nothing. And the investigator looked up at me and he said, I think you just broke our ghost. And we all started laughing and everybody kind of relaxed. But one of the Booth brothers kept his camera on the machine. And as we were all just kind of distracted, suddenly the hum began to build up. And much to our surprise, through the machine, we heard. And we all started laughing. I go, now, how in the hell could a little girl from the turn of the century, early 1900s, through the 1940s, know Inagata De Vita? And yet we all heard it. Now, was it because there were 20 or 30 people there focused and wanting to hear this? And Happy Birthday is such a quick recognizable song. London Bridge is such a quick recognizable song that our mental capacity was able to make that hum quicker. And Inagata De Vita took a little longer to kind of send that signal in. But to me, it seemed impossible for this little girl from the time frame people want to believe she exists from would have that kind of awareness and understanding to play a contemporary song. And I don't know, what's your take when you have an experiment like that that kind of takes a whole new jump?
It always raises more questions, and that's kind of the part that makes it a bit like quicksand, is once you start getting in it and the experiments that you described and you start getting results, and then you throw something into the process like you did, putting in a song from the 1960s that would not be familiar to somebody from when the Queen Mary was sailing in 1939. Actually, it was docked in, 64, I believe. So it's
67, I think, wasn't it? Yeah.
67, yeah. Yeah, you're right, 67. So that was actually a really good thing to do, but the fact that you guys started to get kind of, responses from it, it kind of begs the question that I think is what you posed at the beginning of the show, is that are the living somehow contributing to this manifestation, if that's what we want to call it, manifestation of evidence that appears to be a ghost? Some people take a different viewpoint. I tend to go in the direction that I just stated, that I think somehow the living power of communication, what is believed by some to be the dead, but the living are providing that energy field. I believe that. But other people were critical of, like, my experiment, which I know we're going to talk about more later, but in a Pearl experiment and in creating a thought form on purpose or trying to, was thought to be irresponsible by some people because there's some fear that people have that there's masqueraders that would come in, entities that only want to cause damage and mayhem, would come in when there's an opportunity. They could come and present themselves as being the personality that you're trying to communicate with, and they may have another goal. Now, I don't necessarily share that kind of fear, but there's two viewpoints on why something that appear to be communicating is in the first place, what its intent is, and where it's getting its knowledge.
Right, and I know a lot of people jump on the demonic bandwagon and automatically assume, especially if it's taking on the guise of a child, that it's trying to play upon our weaknesses and want and desire to help. And that, in some cases, as a lot of our demonologists and exorcism friends have told us, when you kind of open that doorway that, and allow something to become part of your life, that's when it can start to gain control. So I do see some of the fear-mongering of people, sharing that theory. But, I think we've seen in situations like with Jackie aboard the Queen Mary and some of these other experiments, it never seems to turn to a dark or sinister tone.
No, it doesn't. And I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, I think you may have had some visual anomalies that you reported, and I know I saw these things. They appeared to be like little sparkles, little.
Right.
And that is the oddest thing. I mean, I've only seen that on the Queen Mary, actually. Particularly when you go down in the hull of the ship and everybody's trying to have any kind of success with their session, their communication attempt session. And then you see these sparkles and it's in front of you. You don't know how far it is. You can't touch them, but they're visual. And sometimes they appear to be little blue sparkles. And I think you and I were both like, "One, is this an optical illusion? Are our eyes adjusting to the dark and their pinholes?" But it couldn't be because the sparkles are moving. And what are they?
And we would both see them. Groups of us would see them. It wasn't just one person whose eyes were adjusting at a different rate than someone else. And it was, Craig, I think we were down in the hull of the Queen Mary when that part of the ship was still available for visitation. And I would witness those. To explain it for the listeners, if you remember at the beginning of The Wonderful World of Disney, when Tinkerbell would fly around and then she'd go to the top of the tower and tap it and you'd see the sparks fly. That's very similar to what this imagery was. You just see these sparkles in the air. And I've the Queen Mary was the first place I ever encountered them. And I've only just recently re-encountered them here in Minnesota at the saloon down in Anoka. And I saw the exact same phenomena, which I've never witnessed again. It's really astounding to see something that different. And then it was as though as soon as we saw that, we began having activity in both locations.
Yes. Yes. And you know, there's no way to measure that. As a matter of fact, when you and I were down there in the hall with groups and we were seeing that, it was sort of building up the momentum and the crescendo of what was happening down there. And everybody started to sort of feel like something was going to happen. And then the visual anomalies appeared. But I had cameras running all over the place and, you know, infrared cameras primarily because we didn't have any other lights except a little lantern, which we extinguished, and it was too faint or of a part of the light spectrum that our eyes could see, but my infrared cameras were unable to record. And I wasn't able to get any of it on video, but, you know, we all saw it. When I say all, many of us reported it and could see it. And when you would see it, there were tiny little pinpoints, but they were very bright and they were moving.
Very, very strange. And I know you and I, along with Erica Frost, who was at the time the resident psychic aboard the Queen Mary, had gone down there with my assistant, Sonia, and we were investigating in the hull area. And it's known for the strange croaking noise as well, this anomalous croaking, which sounds like a giant frog creature somewhere, and it moves around where you can't locate where it's coming from. And we were all down there kind of waiting for this to begin, and as we were talking, the strange anomaly that kind of happened that night, if you recall, Peter James, we had just lost him, unfortunately, and he had passed away. And as we were all down there chatting, we began hearing what sounded almost like a Darth Vader type of and it was only a little later that we found out that actually Peter James in the last stages of his life, I guess, was on some type of breathing apparatus. And we had made comments that night of how disappointed we were that we weren't going to be able to investigate with Peter. He had been signed up to become a part of the event that we were going to be hosting there. And it almost seemed as though he was still there with us. Do you recall that moment?
I do. I do recall that moment. And it was... like you said, there was nothing threatening about it, but it could still be a bit unnerving because I think we all wanted to have Peter there, and it did seem like strained breathing that we were hearing. And yes, I heard in his, you know, later stages before he passed, he was suffering from some breathing issues.
Now, isn't it interesting, though, we were talking kind of about intent earlier with you know, all of us watching and wanting to hear Happy Birthday and wanting to hear London Bridge, and then the expectations lowered when I asked for Inagata Davida, and it took longer for it to begin to play. In this sense, we had no intention of hearing or experiencing Peter James. We didn't go there to seek the spirit of Peter James. We went there to seek this strange croaking noise. But in this case, in that specific scenario, it's interesting to me because that seems to play kind of opposite or in the face of the idea of if you put intention or belief or want and desire into something, we may manifest it. This seemed to manifest in spite of our intention or belief or what we were there to seek out.
Well, that's true. And there's no way that we could set the stage to recreate that to happen again. It did seem like it was spontaneous. It caught us off guard, but you could hear it. It was noticeable. We didn't know where it was coming from. To bounce back for just a quick moment about the croaking sound, I just want to mention that I was able to record that. As a matter of fact, the loudest I ever heard it. I'm fortunate that I had numerous cameras rolling at that moment. And all that is in my Queen Mary DVD, A Floating Phenomena. It's in there from the very beginning. That's how I even started, because it was such a... an odd sound that we didn't know where it was coming from, and people with audio recorders would go to the side of the ship. They would think the sound was originating, but it would move to the other side.
Check out the DVD and more at ghosttown.tv. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more Bill Murphy and more Creating Spirit on Coast to Coast AM right after this.